You're the third person on scene. Time is 10:28 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesday morning, the 9th of January, 2013, and Van Arian's just arrived. That makes it three of us. Judge has just arrived, so Van says. Good idea on the hand sanitizer. There's a flu going around, I hear.
Yeah, I just coughed a second ago. Don't know where that came from. Now I got some phlegm in my throat. It's not a good thing. I can't afford to be sick.
No, that's for sure. You know, Gene Upton was sick.
I did not.
She was coughing for 4 or 5 days. And she woke up on her front steps in her house, inside. Been out for who knows how many hours.
Wow.
She was dehydrated. Extremely sick.
Man named Desmond, Mr. Desmond, says to extend his respects to you this morning.
From yeah.
The Patriots, Patriots of East Tennessee.
Yeah. Kevin.
Correct. Mr. Kevin Desmond. Talked to him yesterday for about an hour and a half. Good conversation.
Oh, jeez.
Here you go.
Thank you.
I got one of those, too.
Out of this. I mean, it's pretty much a formality. Is
to my way of thinking, he's got to order a new trial, but that's just me.
Well, if I was, I mean, yeah. This is the opportunity for the trial judge to reconsider. He's had a month to reconsider everything he's done.
Just so that I'm clear about this, okay. I've said this before, and I'm, you know, it's a sticking point with me, but the charging documents they carry no weight. They were forged by Bruce Arp. He was already in commission of another court at the time.
He's not even considering that today.
I know. But you have him. The charging documents are completely unmeritorious. They're just worthless. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then they take these worthless charging documents into a grand jury. It's headed by this woman who's not even a juror, Miss Tennyson. We've got that proven now. By the way, Miss Tennyson is not the grand jury foreman in 2013. We just checked it's a woman named June Thompson.
Okay.
So nobody who's been a player in this up to this point to get this into a trial court setting has been legit. There are laws broken all the way to get this into a trial court setting, and that is driving me nuts. Nobody is legit. They can't point to a single piece of paper. That's like the judge from the Sessions Court, J. Reed Dixon, said you have to pick a whole new group of people. Okay, and even if Ms. Tennyson had been operating under a judicially recognized appointing order signed by a judge, and that she was legally in place in 2012, she was not allowed to be in the March term 2012 grand jury that heard this case. Why? Because Dixon said, you're out. Everybody knew. So, I'll leave it at that.
The only thing we're here to consider is the trial.
I understand. Got that. I read your brief.
All of that stuff, any of that stuff that I can make an argument that the court would even consider is going to be...
Yeah. I get that.
And that happens regardless of what happens today.
But I bring that to your attention because that's the kind of thing that this judge has had to reflect upon over the course of the past month.
Yeah. I, guarantee the only thing he's been reflecting upon is his rulings at trial.
Right.
Primarily whether or not the necessity defense should have been allowed.
Well, then there his conduct during the course of the trial. You know, you know, yelling at me like he did. You know, criminal contempt issue. No. I'll be quiet.
Let me sit and review here for
yes,
a minute.
Sir. Yes, sir. Time is 10:34 hours Eastern Standard Time. It's Wednesday morning, the 9th of January 2013.
The Honorable Judge Walter Church presiding, the United States State of Tennessee in this court. Thank you. You may be seated.
Time is 11:15. Time is 11:15 hours local Eastern Standard Time.
Governor, is there a record, Governor?
No, I don't believe we do. We have a court reporter here.
Okay. We have had up to this point in the proceedings, I think, so I wanted to make sure we didn't have one.
Well, Mr. Rush came back in chambers and apologized to me, and I accept his apology, but I am going to enter this order. Assistant District Attorney Paul Rush was inexcusably late to court on January 9, 2013. The court sanctioned him $35 to be paid to the court within 2 hours, signed by me.
Thank you, Your Honor. And my apologies to defense counsel as well, defendant. I don't.
Okay, well, these things happen, but as I said to you back in chambers, the hearing was set orally in open court, and then the judge followed it up with a written order that was copied to you at a correct address. So,
that's correct. And I am ready to proceed today, Your Honor. I'm prepared.
Okay. Good morning again.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Okay. Your defendant's motion for a new trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
I read it.
Very well, Your Honor. I think it's pretty self-explanatory, and we're just here for your ruling, unless you have questions or want to hear argument.
Well, I heard your argument before, and you briefed it. I don't want to say that I don't think you need to launch into a 15-minute argument, but if you want to make your salient points.
I would be happy to, Your Honor.
You're welcome to.
The two primary grounds for the motion for new trial were that the court denied the defendant an opportunity to testify and present evidence in support of his necessity defense, and that actually rises to the level of denying him a constitutional right to defend himself. And also that the necessity defense should have been, instructions should have been given to the jury, and defense counsel should have been allowed to argue for the necessity defense at closing. The two elements of the necessity defense are very simple, that the person reasonably believes the conduct is imminently necessary to avoid imminent harm, and the desirability and urgency of avoiding the harm clearly outweighs, according to ordinary standards of reasonableness, the harm sought to be prevented by the law prescribing the conduct. As was testified to by the defendant in an offer of proof, the defendant was prepared to testify that he met with an FBI agent the day before he was arrested on the current charges, and that FBI agent instructed him that he needed to find specific types of evidence, and that the documents at issue here were exactly the type of evidence that he needed to procure in order to get the FBI interested in investigating a massive jury tampering by government officials. We also heard the court testify on behalf of the prosecution, excuse me, the court clerk testify on behalf of the prosecution that the harm done to the government by the action prosecuted was minimal. Basically, a court clerk had to listen to a recording of the jury selection proceedings, get some names, and send out some letters. The fact that an FBI agent instructed the defendant to on the types of evidence that was required to possibly support this jury tampering allegation means that his thoughts at the time that he took the documents were, his thoughts that taking the documents was eminently necessary to was necessary to prevent imminent harm was objectively reasonable. The harm being caused was much less than the harm sought to be prevented, which was massive countywide jury tampering by government officials. And the requirement that the documents be secured in order to prevent them from being destroyed was also supported by evidence presented by the prosecution that normal standard operating procedure would be to take these documents, enter the information into a computer, and then discard the documents. So, and the defendant was aware of this at the time. So this is a situation where he knew that the handwritten, the documents that included handwritten writing on it from a judge were going to be destroyed if he didn't secure them. And regardless of what this court thinks about the believability of the evidence presented, the precedent is clear that that's, that this court is absolutely not to weigh that evidence at all. That all that needs to be done is that these elements need to be fairly raised. That's a standard that is lower than a preponderance of the evidence. And we believe that the elements of necessity of defense were fairly raised, and we ask for a new trial so that we can present that evidence to a jury and argue it to a jury.
Your Honor, my argument is essentially what it was in the trial, if you recall, which is that this is not the kind of case that necessity defense was designed for. If you do stretch it to a matter like this or a situation like this, one has to ask what was accomplished or what was attempted to have been accomplished by the taking of these records. Of themselves, there was no evidence even proffered that it proved any corruption, that it proved any misdeed, that it did anything in even furthering the defendant's own theory. And what defense counsel says is not exactly the case. You have to raise a defense that fairly fits the facts, not just that the defendant thought he was in necessity. That's not the defense. It needs to be a necessity. And in this case, if you recall, the defendant himself testified, or gave proffer, that he already had the name and the phone number of one of the grand jurors themselves that he even sat next to. In fact, you know, we know that, that on behalf of Mr. Fitzpatrick, that grand juror was contacted. So, you know, in this case, where's the necessity? And exactly what does the action of taking the records itself accomplish? It's not like that this was a smoking gun. It's not like this was, well, Your Honor, there has to be a necessity presented. That the defendant thought it was a necessity isn't itself a necessity. It has to be, a lot of people might act where they think is in self-defense, but it's not available as a defense, because the facts don't fit a self-defense theory. And in this case, it doesn't matter if he thought he was acting in necessity, it clearly was not a necessity.
Your Honor. First, the defense of necessity is statutory. The statute and no precedent limits that defense to any particular type of situation. There is precedent that talks about the most common situations where life is in danger. There is absolutely nothing in the commentary, in the statute, or in the precedent that limits the necessity defense to a specific type of situation. The elements are what the elements are that the legislature passed. Second, the prosecution's argument is essentially arguing that Your Honor should be deciding whether or not the evidence should be believed, whether or not the it was reasonable for the defendant to believe that the evidence would have prevented jury tampering. This is not the job of the court in this case. All we need to do is present evidence, and prosecution also misstated that evidence was not proffered, that the evidence was, or that this was evidence of jury tampering. The defendant specifically discussed codes that were being violated. Whether or not, and we're not here to try whether or not those court codes were being violated, and I believe that that may have been one of the things that this court considered, and I would argue that it's not the place of, for this trial to determine whether or not jury tampering is actually happening. The standard for the necessity defense is for us to present evidence to a jury and for the jury to determine whether or not it was reasonable under the circumstances at the time for the defendant to believe that his actions were necessary at the time to prevent a greater harm. That is a question for the jury to decide, and
okay. Well, I agree with the defense that the judge isn't in a position to make a credibility call about this defense. I had to credit the defendant's testimony, but if you look at the two, most important cases in this area, one published, State versus Watkins, written by Judge Smith, at 1 Southwest 3rd, 676, and another one decided by Judge Wade when he was presiding judge of the Court of Criminal Appeals, State versus Blevins, 2005 Westlaw 1081768. Read the statute at 3911609 and the comments under the statute. You come to this conclusion: the defense of necessity excuses conduct in the rare situations where criminal activity is reasonable in response to an extreme situation to avoid imminent harm and is the only means available. In every situation, what we've got is like a drunk driver who has to drive an injured person to the hospital. A couple of examples given in the horn books: ship violates embargo law to avoid a storm. A person breaks into a cabin to get warm to escape freezing to death. Those examples. This does not in no way allow a person to be a self-appointed vigilante to investigate what he or she believes are violations of grand jury selection process. So, and as far as limiting the defense, again, I refer back to State versus Watson at 1 Southwest 3rd, 676, wherein the defendant made an offer of proof, the trial judge wouldn't allow him to testify because it didn't rise to the level of even a colorable necessity defense. So the motion for a new trial is respectfully overruled. Since we don't have a court reporter present, I will enter a short written order when I get back to Nashville, just memorializing the reasons for my ruling. And then the matter can be further resolved if the defendant wants to the Court of Criminal Appeals. What's the defendant's bond?
$1,000.
And who made the bond?
Brad's bond.
Okay, well, I have no intent of tinkering with the amount of the bond, just want to make sure the bonding company is willing to remain on the bond. Uh, Okay, I'm going to ask the defendant just to remain here in the courtroom. I have no reason to believe the bonding company wouldn't stay on the bond, but I'm going to have the clerk check with the bonding company to make sure they're willing to stay on the bond. Otherwise, it'll just remain the same and need to remain on the same bond pending the appeal. If the clerk comes out and says that it's okay with the bonding company, they'll stick on the bond, then he's excused. If for some reason they say no, I'll stay here until we get an answer, and then we'll, if they say no, we'll figure out where to go from there. But I suspect they'll say yes, and they usually do.
Matt, I'm just asking a question about procedure because this is different than what I'm usually seeing. Is there not, are we delaying imposition of the sentence until the appeals have run? Is that what you're
arguing? We are. I think it is a misdemeanor case given the sentence imposed that I'll stay any imposition of the sentence until the Court of Criminal Appeals does whatever they're going to do.
And that would be a year? Isn't that a year that defense counsel has to file the appeal now?
Mr. Rush, you'll have to take that up with the presiding judge of the Court of Criminal Appeals. I've heard is how quick they'll get to it. Now, if no notice of appeal is filed, then the matter will be imposed and the stay will be lifted. But assuming a notice of appeal is filed, then I'll let you take it up with the Court of Criminal Appeals about how quick they get to the and decide to get.
That's what I was trying to ask. Was what is the? Do you know the statutory limit for the notice of appeal?
I believe it's 30 days. I think it's 30 days.
30 days
from
the entry of your order on this motion.
Right. They're okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the binding company says they're okay, so Mr. Fitzpatrick is free to leave. Pending whatever the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Thank you, Your Honor. Look forward to your opinion, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right. Time is, according to the clock in the courtroom, it's 11:31 hours. 11:31 hours. Wednesday morning, the 9th of January, 2013, and that ends this recording.